Abortion pills, sometimes called a chemical abortion, sometimes more nefariously called a medical abortion. Whatever the name, abortion pills are in the news like never before. At the recent Supreme Court rally outside the court for the Dobbs case in Mississippi, abortion activists staged a PR event where they took, allegedly, abortion pills live for the camera, chanting, "Abortion pills forever." Abortion, at any stage, is gruesome, especially late-term abortions. Abortion pills are the pro-abortion solution, if you can call it that, to a post-Roe America, because pro-abortion activists believe that abortion pills can and should be unregulated and available vending machine style, despite the life-threatening nature of abortion pills, especially when dispensed without a visit to a doctor. We'll hear more about abortion pills in today's special episode with Dr. Donna Harrison. Dr. Harrison is a physician, board certified in obstetrics and gynecology. Dr. Harrison is currently serving as chief executive officer of the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists. This is the largest non-sectarian pro-life physician organization in the world, with over 6,000 members across the United States and associate members on every continent. I am Tom Shakley, and this is Life, Liberty, and Law. Welcome to Life, Liberty, and Law from Americans United for Life, where we advance the human right to life in culture, law, and policy. And I'm thrilled to introduce today a very special conversation led by Dr. Donna Harrison. We're listening in today to one of AUL's quarterly calls on advancing the human right to life. AUL is headquartered, as you probably know, here in Washington, D.C., and for many years, we've hosted talks and lunches and seminars and events with experts on issues across the spectrum of human right to life issues. Now, when COVID hit, we shifted these in-person events and talks and lunches to quarterly calls. Now, while we're returning to many of these events in person in Washington, we've realized that these quarterly calls can and should continue to exist. We've heard from so many across the country and the world who have dialed in and participated in a way that just wasn't possible before. And we want to make these quarterly calls as inclusive as possible. Well, today we're going to share with you one of these quarterly calls. These aren't always public. Many of them are invitation only. But we want to share today's conversation led by Dr. Donna Harrison. We hear today first from Clark Forsyth, Senior Counsel at Americans United for Life. Clark will introduce Dr. Donna Harrison, who speaks on abortion pills and the strategy of abortion activists in a post-Roe America. And by the way, if you're interested in joining future AUL quarterly calls, to be on the call live, to be able to ask questions, just email life@AUL.org and you can get signed up to receive invitations to our future quarterly calls. All right, with that said, let's listen in.
Welcome everyone to this call with Americans United for Life on research on the risks of abortion to women. Thank you for joining us. I'm Clark Forsyth, Senior Counsel with Americans United for Life, and I'll be moderating today's call, which we will keep to 60 minutes. Given our hopes for the Dobbs decision, which may come in May or possibly June, and the full press campaign for do-it-yourself abortion by abortion advocates, I don't know of any more pressing abortion data issue than the one we're addressing today, which is the latest data on the risks of chemical abortion. The purpose of these quarterly calls is to bring together pro-life laypeople and researchers to keep abreast of recent publications, to discuss data and studies so that we can effectively analyze and understand medical studies on the risks to women from abortion and discuss them in publications and testimony in the media. We want to keep up to date on recent abortion studies so that we can better understand their strengths and weaknesses. And we wish to foster a network to share studies and their interpretation and understanding. And we aim to discuss the studies at a level that lay people can understand, because I happen to be one of those lay people and want to understand this data as well as I can. Before today's call, via email, you should have received, and we distributed some material for background, along with three articles on chemical abortion that we will address today. The three articles that we will address today are the ACOG, American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists Practice Bulletin from 2020 on chemical abortion up to 70 days, the Cerucci article on discrepancies in the reporting of mifepristone adverse events by Planned Parenthood in 2009 and 2010, and third, the Stanicki study on emergency room visits after chemical abortion between 1999 and 2015. And then for background only, due to our time limits, we also emailed the Vice News 15-minute video on the trafficking of chemical abortion between Texas and Mexico, and the Altman paper that we addressed in prior calls. If you would like to receive any of those materials, and you haven't up to now, please email jesse.sutherland@aul.org, and he'll send them to you. Just a reminder, please mute your phones at this time. Keep your camera off as well. Our format will be as follows, and it's pretty simple. For those in the media on the call, the comments made during the call are for background only. If you want an interview on the record, please contact the speaker directly. I'll briefly introduce Dr. Harrison. She will address the three papers, and then we'll open it up for questions at the bottom of the hour. And if you have questions for Dr. Harrison, please post them in the chat area of your screen. And I'll aim to get to all of them in the second half of this call. So our guest today is Dr. Donna Harrison. She earned her MD from the University of Michigan and has been an expert on chemical abortion since at least the mid-1990s. She has published several studies on RU46 or mifepristone and misoprostol, including co-authoring two of the papers that she'll be talking about today. She currently serves as the CEO of the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists, or APLOG. Thank you very much, Donna, for joining us today, and take it away.
Thank you very much, Clark. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to talk about this really important topic. What I plan to do is to go through the ACOG Practice Bulletin first, and then after you see the ACOG Practice Bulletin and we've examined some of the important areas, then to talk about the Cerucci and Studnicki papers, and maybe also mention the Altman paper that Clark had referenced as well. So, first of all, if you want to pull up the ACOG Practice Bulletin that was just recently done, this is Practice Bulletin 225, published in 2020. It's entitled Medication Abortion Up to 70 Days of Gestation. The first thing I want to make clear is what this document is and what it is not. Okay, an ACOG Practice Bulletin is generally guidelines that a committee has digested for the practicing OB-GYN to use to guide their practice. Theoretically, it has brought together the latest of information on the topic and should give a pro and con, and then at the end, recommendations with their level of evidence base. The ACOG Practice Bulletin on Abortion, however, is not exactly that document. This document and the document before it, 143 in 2014, are documents that are basically made for the courtroom productions. They are documents to cover the practices of abortionists, and they are written by abortionists, as is this one. Mitchell Krinan and Daniel Grossman, who are co-authors on this document, are both academic people for the abortion industry. Daniel Grossman's heavily involved with Gynuity and with Danco. Mitchell Krinan has been a speaker for Danco. They are heavily financially involved in the abortion industry and in medication abortion itself. Daniel Grossman, in his tweets, has said outrageous things and advocates for the complete demedicalization, you know, vending machine dispensing of abortion drugs. So that is important to understand when you look at, when we examine what's actually being said in this document. The other aspect of this is that I have testified against Daniel Grossman in probably, half a dozen, maybe even a dozen cases across the country on medication abortion. And this practice bulletin looks like a cut and paste from most of his declarations. So it is highly likely that a lot of the wording here is, again, Center for Reproductive Rights influenced in order to make this a document that can be referred to in the courtroom against any kind of limitation for medication abortion in any state. Now, with that background, let me go through some of the more important points for you to understand in this document. Okay, so as we go through the background, epidemiology, I want you to note that at the bottom of that first paragraph, it says a recent survey of ACOG fellows and junior fellows found that 14% had provided medication abortion in the prior year. I want to translate that a little bit. What that means is that 96% have not. And in fact, studies looking at how many OB-GYNs perform abortion, if you look at OB-GYNs in private practice, the latest study is that 93% of OB-GYNs in private practice do not do abortions. If you look at academics, those OB-GYNs who are practicing in an academic setting, you've got 75% who do not perform abortion. So abortion and medication abortion is not mainstream medical care. It's not mainstream OB-GYN care. And I think it was profound that the acknowledgement of that is actually in the reverse reading of the survey of ACOG fellows and junior fellows. The medication abortion regimen, they summarize very well. But then in the paragraph under the last paragraph on the right-hand column, the FDA currently restricts mifepristone access under the REMS. Now, REMS is a risk evaluation mitigation strategy that the FDA established back in the, early 2000s. And what it does is it allows the FDA some ability to control the conditions under which a drug can be distributed when there are significant safety concerns with that drug. Mifepristone hit the REMS very early, and the safety concerns have to do with establishing the gestational age, ensuring that somebody is ruling out ectopic pregnancy, and also that the patients are informed about mifepristone's complications, and that they've been given in writing the summary of what they've been told. So they're not onerous REMS. They do not actually restrict Mifeprex access, other than you can't dispense a drug with a REMS from the pharmacy. You can't dispense, it's not a willy-nilly dispensing. And the end game of the abortion industry is to make this drug, Mifeprex, available over the counter with no medical supervision whatsoever. That is their end game. That's their stated end game, as has Grossman has described that multiple times. So down here, this is where you start to get into the legal talk here. So this is almost a quote from several of his declarations. The REMS restrictions for Mifeprex do not make the care safer, are not based on medical evidence or need, and create barriers, blah, blah, blah. This is the claims of the abortion industry. How accurate are those claims? And that's what I want to address as we go on in this document. Also, I want you to note that the American College of OB-GYNs, despite being a C3, is advocating for the removal of REMS restrictions. And they make no bones about their pro-abortion advocacy. So let's look at clinical considerations and recommendations. If we go down to the middle of this paragraph, okay, the beginning of the paragraph talks about patients who choose abortion should be counseled about all methods available, risks, advantages, disadvantages. And I couldn't agree more. They should be counseled about all of those things. They are not currently being accurately counseled. if you go down to the about the second half of that paragraph, compared with uterine aspiration, that is a surgical abortion, medication abortion takes longer to complete, requires more active patient participation as the pregnancy expels outside of a clinical setting. So what does that mean? That means that there are patients for whom medication abortion should not be the primary method. Patients who are unable to get to emergency medical care, patients who don't understand that they have to participate this. This isn't a pop a pill and poof, it's gone. This is an arduous procedure to pass a pregnancy via the medication abortion. And some patients are not candidates. However, who makes that call? Who makes that call? That is generally, when we look at patient screening, that's a medical judgment call. So if you isolate these patients from medical care, if you demedicalize this procedure, no one's making that call. Anyone who is susceptible to marketing, and the marketing is egregious, 100% effective, no complications, don't need anybody around. You know, I mean, just ridiculous claims that are being made right now online. Anyone who is susceptible to that kind of marketing is the one who will participate in a clinical, in the Mifeprex abortion procedure, even if they can't access medical care. So let's go on down. What information and counseling should be provided to patients who are considering medical abortion? Okay, so they talk about most patients who desire medical abortion are eligible. Well, what does that mean? That means they can get it. Are they good candidates? It's a completely different thing. And if you notice, it's just the paragraph above basically saying that this is a long, arduous procedure. And so most patients who desire it may not be, even though they're eligible, they may not be good candidates. There are now I want to take a quote here. There are medical conditions for which a medication abortion may be preferable to uterine aspiration. Such examples include blah, blah, blah. This is a cut and paste from probably 10 to 15 years of Grossman's testimony. Such examples include uterine fibroids that distort the canal or uterine cavity, congenital uterine anomalies, or scarring. Okay. Infibulation is female circumcision, where the opening to the vagina has been permanently sewn shut except for a pinhole opening. They make this bold claim with no evidence to support superior outcomes from medical versus surgical abortion in these cases. And the reason that this is such a problem is that if you need to have a D&C after a medication abortion, it's generally because you're hemorrhaging. That means you present to the ER in an emergency situation, not under control, and then who knows who is going to do that D&C or attempt that D&C. If you have a uterine fibroid that distorts the cervical canal, which is the opening into the womb, or the uterine cavity, which is the place where the baby's implanted, you have a much higher risk of perforating that uterus if you are under emergency circumstances and if the patient is hemorrhaging. So despite zero, and I mean zero evidence that there is a superior outcome from medication abortion versus surgical abortion, they make these wild claims. Congenital uterine anomalies, that's the same thing. The uterus is distorted. And so under these circumstances where you've got distortion of uterine anatomy, emergency surgery becomes much, much more difficult. It is much better to do if one has to empty the uterus, okay, and there are circumstances where one does have to empty the uterus to save a mother's life. But in those circumstances where you have to empty the uterus to save the mother's life, it is much better to do that under controlled circumstances in the operating room with anesthesia and ultrasound guidance rather than in the ER when a woman comes in hemorrhaging because she's had a Mifeprex abortion. So let's go on a little bit. He talks about what is not a contraindication. But then he goes on to talk about what are contraindications, okay? Medication abortion is not recommended for any of the following: confirmed or suspected ectopic pregnancy. We're going to unpack this a little bit because the only way that you can confirm a suspected ectopic pregnancy is by ultrasound. You can't do it by physical exam. You have to have an ultrasound. And you can't do an ultrasound if it's pharmacy dispensed. You can't do an ultrasound if you're screening by telemedicine and have no way to do an ultrasound on the person. Her body has to be physically present for the ultrasound. So they agree that you should not use medication abortion if there's a suspected ectopic pregnancy. But what the mealy mouth stuff that goes on afterward we'll get into is they basically say, well, you can rule out ectopic pregnancy by risk factors. That is a flat out lie. 50% of women who present with ectopic pregnancy have zero risk factors. Zero. You cannot rule out ectopic pregnancy by risk factor. You must have an ultrasound. And you must document that that pregnancy is inside the uterus. All right, intrauterine devices in place. Okay, who's going to remove her IUD before she takes the medication abortion if she gets this online? Is the pharmacist going to remove her IUD? Who's going to remove it? Is the patient? She has no clue how to remove an IUD. Okay, concurrent long-term systemic corticosteroid therapy. That person is under hospital care. Chronic adrenal failure, coagulopathy, inherited porphyria. These are all medical conditions. But the patient may or may not know or understand the implications of this. So if you are dispensing this drug via the internet, and they say, do you have any reasons you shouldn't have Mifeprex? And the patient says, no, none that I know of. There's no screening for what is actually a contraindication. All right. So we talk about the next thing that is just egregious. If you go a little bit further down in that same paragraph, it says the safety of medication abortion in patients with anemia is unknown because studies have excluded patients with anemia who have hemoglobin levels of less than 9.5. Okay, let's stop there a minute. How is a woman going to know what her hemoglobin level is? She has to have her blood tested. Who's going to test her? Who's screening for anemia? So what they admit here is that it may not. The medication abortion may be very, very dangerous for women who have a low blood count, who have anemia. And no one will screen these women, if these women are getting the meds through the internet. You can't, you know, the computer doesn't screen you for anemia. Why is that an issue? Because you hemorrhage with this procedure. And if you have all 2/3 of your blood volume, and you hemorrhage half that, that means you have basically, you know, 1/3 of your blood volume left. That's the edge of dying, guys. So this is not an insignificant problem. And what ACOG is doing here is hanging a lantern on their shortcoming. They are saying, oh, yes, safety of medication abortion, we don't know, but it's okay to give this anyway. And so they go on to say the transfusion rate is low, less than 0.1%, but they actually don't know. And I'll get into that a bit more when we talk about the papers. And the transfusion rate, they do admit, exceeds those reported for surgical abortion, that is uterine evacuation. So what they're admitting here is that women with anemia are in greater danger by taking a Mifeprex abortion than by surgical abortion. But essentially, we don't care. Okay. So I'm going to go on to the last sentence. Patients may also not be good candidates for medication abortion if they're unable or unwilling to adhere to care instructions, that is, label comprehension studies, desire quick completion of the abortion process, are not available for follow-up or evaluation, or cannot understand the instructions because of comprehension barriers. Who's screening for that? Who's screening for follow-up contact? If they are in such a situation that they don't have access to surgical abortion, that they are in rural or are medically underserved areas, then who is going to be available for follow-up? Who's going to evaluate? And this is part, so in this paragraph here, the eligibility and contraindications, ACOG highlights the major arguments in APLOG's declarations over the last 10 years. They've highlighted and admitted. They put it up front to say, well, you know, our august body has considered all these things and basically they don't matter. But the fact is they do matter and patients will die because of this. So let's go on in the practice bulletin. talk about the procedure itself and what patients become aware of. So adverse events commonly associated with Mifeprex and misoprostol. They don't actually say Mifeprex, but it's the regimen. Okay, so adverse effects commonly associated with misoprostol: nausea, vomiting, headache, diarrhea, dizziness, fever, chills, hot flashes. Okay. These are the majority of women. Okay. So when these women experience these things, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, headache, dizziness, and then they're hemorrhaging and they're in pain, in the midst of all of that, they're supposed to make clear-headed decisions about how much bleeding is too bleeding. It's too much bleeding. So if you look at the next paragraph, it says, patient counseling should include discussion of when patients should contact their clinician in the case of heavy bleeding and when to access urgent intervention. Who's going to take these women with nausea, vomiting, headache, hemorrhaging, dizziness, fever, chills, hot flashes? Who's going to take them to the ER? Is there someone even who's going to be with them? And if women are getting access to medication abortion without any kind of medical supervision, and in some cases without the knowledge of anybody else, then these patients are extremely vulnerable when they're in that situation of actually expelling the baby. Okay, in rare cases, well, we'll talk about rare. The practice bulletin, like I said, reads just like Grossman's declarations over the last 10 years. We have been arguing in court after court what rare means. It turns out that there's a numerical definition of a very common, common, uncommon, and rare. Rare means less than 1 in 100,000. This is not true. When patients undergo a medication abortion, a Mifeprex abortion, and they need surgery, it's about 5% at least. That runs into the definition, the CIOMS definition of common. Common is anywhere between 1 and 10%. So you've got 5% of patients. It's a common that patients need medication abortion. Need surgical intervention after medication abortion. Okay, they go on to quote some the needs for intervention. And again, there's a little bit of doublespeak here. So the need for intervention within the first 24 hours of treatment is rare. Okay, now let's unpack this so that you understand. So they've gotten mifepristone, and it depends on what you call the first 24 hours of treatment. Mifepristone is supposed to be followed by vaginal misoprostol more than 24 hours later. So when they're looking at how many women need intervention, they need intervention after they've taken the Mifeprex and misoprostol, and generally days after that. So they go on in this paragraph to say, a baseline hemoglobin or hematocrit, if known, may also influence when to seek care. Notice that without having a physician evaluation or some evaluation where you check a woman for anemia before she gets the Mifeprex and misoprostol, you won't have a baseline hemoglobin or hematocrit. Okay, so they're saying here, well, you got to know what her hemoglobin is to know how much blood she's lost in order to know whether or not to send her to the ER. But if you've never checked her before, you don't know what her baseline hemoglobin is. So how are you going to know when she should seek urgent care? So this document belies the doublespeak that's going on here. They reference, yes, appropriate care, yeah, check her baseline hemoglobin, see how much she's bled. But if you don't have a baseline hemoglobin, you can't do that. So you can't do the things that they're talking about or suggesting for care unless she's actually seen by a physician prior to the administration of Mifeprex. All right. So let's go down a little bit further. Under this teratogenicity and ongoing pregnancy, let's look at the second paragraph. In the very rare case, they say that patients change their mind about having an abortion after taking mifepristone and want to continue the pregnancy, they should be monitored expectantly. Okay. It's not very rare. And the reason I can tell you that is because I, along with a group of others, reviewed the adverse events that were submitted to the FDA, which the FDA released by FOIA. And by the way, they only released half of them, which we found out later. But what we found was of 452 patients who had ongoing pregnancies that were mentioned in the adverse event reports, 22% of those chose to keep their baby, and 32% had terminations. And about half of them, we didn't know what the outcome was because there was no documentation of outcome. So when you look at that, what that really means is of those women who had babies, a live baby, after taking the Mifeprex, and they chose to continue, 41% of women who we know the outcome of, 41% of those chose to keep the baby. That is not the rare case that patients change their mind. All right, now let's look again. I want to read this paragraph in its entirety, because it contains some massive untruths that it's important to understand. It says, in the very rare case that patients change their mind about having an abortion after taking Mifeprex, and want to continue the pregnancy, they should be monitored expectantly. Now let's skip down to the last sentence. Limited available evidence suggests that the use of mifepristone alone without subsequent administration of misoprostol may be associated with an increased risk of hemorrhage. This is actually completely untrue. And why can I say that? Because let's look at the Crinan study, okay? The Crinan study that they are referencing. Crinan, who is one of the co-authors on this practice bulletin and a notorious abortionist, he analyzed a total of 10, yes, 10, T-E-N, women in this study. Five of those women had Mifeprex alone. Five had Mifeprex followed by progesterone. In the arm with Mifeprex alone, two of the five, so 40%, had continued pregnancies with a heartbeat at 2 weeks. With Mifeprex alone, nothing else, two of the five had severe hemorrhaging requiring surgery, and one of those had to be transfused. That is a, 20% transfusion rate? One of five? Now let's compare that to the arm with Mifeprex and progesterone. In the Mifeprex and progesterone, four of the five women, 80%, had continuing pregnancies with a heartbeat. This is double the survival rate of Mifeprex alone. In the arm with Mifeprex and progesterone, one of the women did hemorrhage, but by the time she got to the ER, she stopped. She had no bleeding, she had no ER treatment, no surgery, and no transfusion. So it's extremely clear from Crinan's own data that the risk of hemorrhage is not with progesterone, as none, zero, nada of the women who received progesterone had hemorrhage needing treatment. What's also clear is from the Altman study, the study of the adverse event reports that I mentioned earlier, we looked at women who had hemorrhage. They had documented hemorrhage. And we looked at those women who took Mifeprex and misoprostol and compared that to those who took Mifeprex alone, which we could do. So hemorrhage occurred more often in those who took Mifeprex and misoprostol, i.e. 51.44% of those who hemorrhaged had Mifeprex and misoprostol, than in those who took misoprostol alone. The misoprostol alone group, only 22% of those hemorrhaged. So this is complete baloney salami that Crinan is mentioning here. And yet it gets repeated and repeated and repeated and unchallenged, despite the fact that the Altman paper clearly refutes Crinan's claim, and despite the fact that Crinan's own numbers refute Crinan's claim. So anyway, let's go to the middle of this. It says there is no evidence that treatment with progesterone after taking mifepristone increases the likelihood of the pregnancy continuing. This is also completely untrue. There are both animal models and experience in humans demonstrating clearly that progesterone supplementation increases the chances of fetal survival from 25% to 68%. And if you look at those models, even Crinan's study itself shows evidence that a progesterone supplementation increases survival rate. All right, so let me just summarize some of the most important points. So further on in this practice bulletin, they mentioned that if you take Depo-Provera, which is a kind of contraceptive that has an artificial progestin, not progesterone, they mentioned that you shouldn't take Depo-Provera at the time of the Mifeprex abortion because it will increase the chances of ongoing pregnancy, which is a direct refutation of what they said, that there's no evidence that progesterone supplementation increases the chances. So what do we have here? What we have, like I said, this particular document reads like a cut and paste of Crinan's or of Grossman's declarations last, you know, multiple abortion cases. And it is not a scientific publication as much as it is a publication that is done for the purposes of legally covering abortionists in the courtroom. All right. There are some other important topics in here, but I'm going to summarize and maybe we'll get back to them if we have extra time. So let me talk a little bit here about what we have with the Studnicki paper. So what we did with the Studnicki paper is we looked at what is the outcome, the actual real-world outcome of women who take mifepristone abortions versus those who take surgical abortions. So we looked at the available Medicaid database in those states where Medicaid covers abortion. And the inclusion criteria was women who had paid for a Mifeprex abortion, so there's a charge for Mifeprex and misoprostol, and then looked at their emergency room utilization. How often did they go to the ER? And what we found was that in the real world, ER visits are at greater risk to occur after a Mifeprex abortion than a surgical abortion. And not only that, but abortion-related visits. So when we say ER visits, we mean all ER visits. Could be for a headache. It could be for a suicide attempt. It could be for a drug overdose. All of those are at greater risk to occur following a chemical rather than a surgical abortion. And we also found that abortion-related visits, so visits that specifically had to do with a complication from the abortion, such as retained tissue, hemorrhage, pelvic infection, abortion-related visits were significantly more likely to occur after a chemical abortion rather than a surgical abortion. What we also found was that of abortion-related visits, a large number, so how large, 69% of abortion-related visits were miscoded as a spontaneous abortion-related visit rather than a Mifeprex abortion-related visit. Now you could say, well, you know, we know mifepristone is used for treatment of miscarriage. Yeah, but not 1999 to 2015. So you have to remember our data encompasses a time when mifeprex was not used for treatment of spontaneous abortion. So this is deliberate misinformation given to the ER doc where women. I'm miscarrying. And when in fact they had induced the abortion. Why is that important? Because there are some complications that you would treat a little differently if you knew it was an abortion, if you knew it was after a Mifeprex abortion rather than a spontaneous abortion. Because hemorrhage is more common after a Mifeprex abortion. You'd be less likely to let that person walk out with tissue left inside. You would be more likely to screen them for a particular fatal, although not kind of not common, but a fatal infection called Clostridium sordellii. So with that, you have to have a kind of a high threshold of concern. You have to, if they come in with, you know, fever and chills, which again, remember how often fever and chills are a side effect of misoprostol. If the woman comes in with fever and chills, or even just chills and difficulty temperature regulating, you have to check her white blood count, and a very, very high white blood count is one of the very few unique markers of this fatal infection, Clostridium sordellii. So it's important that we're finding that 60.9% of abortion-related visits were miscoded as spontaneous rather than as a result of chemical abortion. The other reason this is really important is because most of the studies that have been done looking at complication rates after chemical abortion have only used those complications where the woman was coded as a induced abortion, spontaneous, I mean, an induced abortion after Mifeprex, so a legal induced abortion. There's like six different codes that can be coded. And so the Upadhyaya study, which is quoted all over the place, they only looked at one of the six possible codes. We looked at all of them. And that's why we knew that the abortion-related visits are miscoded. And so when you evaluate a paper, look at what their inclusion criteria were for who was considered a abortion-related complication, and then you can double results. All right, I could say more about Studnicki, but we can answer questions. Let me go on just real quickly so that there is time for questions. I want to look at a paper that we published, Christina Cerucci, Kathy Altman, and myself, comparing the mifepristone adverse events identified by Planned Parenthood in the Cleland paper. This is a paper that's often cited as there's only 0.3% of women who ever have a complication. So that's a pivotal paper. And that was, Cleland published that of data from Planned Parenthood between 2009 and 2010. We took that same time period and we compared the adverse events recorded in the FDA FAERS system, adverse event reporting system, and then those that the FDA gave us through the Freedom of Information Act, which formed the basis of our Altman systematic review. And what we found was very interesting. There's significant discrepancies in the number of adverse events, and specifically adverse events for 2009-2010 between Cleland, between the FAERS dashboard, and the adverse events reported through FOIA to us. And what this says is these discrepancies render the FAERS inadequate to evaluate the safety of Mifeprex abortions. What did we actually find? What we found was that the total reports, the Cleland report, which is the Planned Parenthood report, they identified 1,530 cases which involved just 8 specific adverse events between in 2009-2010. The FAERS dashboard had less than half of that. They only had 664 adverse events, and only 333 were provided to us by FOIA. Why is that important? Well, if you look in the Cleland paper, Cleland says that Planned Parenthood reported all of these cases to the FDA. So why doesn't the FAERS dashboard contain all these cases? It's a very interesting question. Did Planned Parenthood lie and not report them? Did FDA not put them on their dashboard, and so they're not being transparent? And then why did the FDA thumb their nose at a FOIA request, which they're required by law to provide, and only provide half of the actual adverse events that occurred? So you can find more details, but that is the nutshell of the Cerucci paper, which compares the FDA adverse events. The more important thing, and kind of the take-home message, why does this matter, is that if you look at the letter from FDA to ACOG and FDA in the cases, the Hawaii case, oh my goodness, blanking on the name, those are cases where the FDA was sued to remove the REMS. And in FDA's response to their plaintiffs, the FDA said, we have determined that we are not going to enforce the in-person dispensing requirement because we've reviewed the FAERS database and there's no difference in adverse events from before COVID to when we dropped the adverse event when we dropped the in-person requirement during COVID. Okay. Let's unpack that a little bit. This paper, the Cerucci paper, directly shows that FDA does not have the whole story from the abortion industry, or is not admitting that they have the whole story from the abortion industry. The But the other more important thing is that in 2019, FDA actually changed the requirements for reporting adverse events. I'm sorry, in 2016, the FDA changed the requirements for reporting adverse events, and they dropped any requirement to report adverse events other than death. So to say that we've reviewed the FAERS system and it doesn't show any change, that's because nobody's reporting. There's no requirement to report. So these kinds of things, you couldn't make them up. It's just such an illustration of the lack of transparency and the lack of ability of FDA to actually have any mechanism whatsoever to evaluate the post-marketing safety of what they initially considered to be a dangerous drug. All right, with that,
Thank you, Donna.
Longer, but we'll leave some time for Q&A.
One question that's been posed involves the what was portrayed on the Vice News video about women taking just misoprostol, not mifepristone, in Mexico. And as I understand it, the FDA has not officially approved misoprostol-only abortions. So what's the difference for the woman who takes misoprostol only rather than the two-drug combination?
Yes, this was extensively evaluated prior to the advent of mifepristone in the development phase. And misoprostol alone, even in the earliest gestational ages, is only about 85% effective in causing abortion. So what does that mean? So 85% means 15% of women will not abort. They'll have tissue left inside. They'll have incomplete miscarriages. And that's one out of six, guys. So and it gets worse as the gestational age increases. So we're talking 7 weeks or less. It's that ineffective, and then it gets worse. And there's actually several papers in the literature performed by abortionists who've evaluated misoprostol alone and said because of the lack of efficacy, misoprostol alone is not sufficient for use as an abortion drug. So what it means for women is that these women will hemorrhage. They will have tissue left inside. They'll have incomplete abortion. And that's, I can't emphasize clinically how important that is. If you have tissue left inside, you get infected, and infections in the reproductive organs can kill you. They're not anything to mess around with, especially when you have dead tissue left inside.
Do you have some examples of patient cases of coming to the ER with serious complications?
Yes. So our chairman of the board was actually working in the ER and had a horrendous Mifeprex abortion case. And so because she knew about the adverse event reporting system, she decided she was going to report it. It took her an hour and a half. She filled out all the forms and found out there was no submit button. And so what she had to do was physically print these off, physically put them in an envelope, and physically send them to Danco and FDA. Again, and a busy ER doc is not going to take an hour and a half to fill out these reports. And the reports that were submitted to the FDA as part of the FAERS system were not submitted, very, very few of them, maybe a dozen, were submitted by the doc who actually took care of the patient in the ER. Over 95% of them were submitted by the abortionist who found out later that the woman went to the ER and by report then submitted that information to Danco. So the people who are actually taking care of these adverse events are not submitting those reports to FDA because it's too onerous. And who knows what happens between the submitting to Danco and getting from Danco to FDA. It's a black box, but there's a lot of discrepancies, numerical discrepancy.
I wanted to mention again that if you have questions for Dr. Harrison, please post them in the chat section of your screen. Donna, one question about the Studnicki study. I mean, basically, it shows that miscoding shows that complications are being filtered out of the entire public health system.
That's That's correct, because again, if you look at the studies that the abortion industry is doing on complications, which involve ER visits, they're only including those women who were correctly coded as legal-induced abortion. So what that means, when you have 60% of abortion-related visits miscoded, is that you're only getting 40%. So if you have a complication rate of 8%, let's say, then double that. And that's really what's going to be the actual complication rate from Mifeprex. So it's going to be more like 16%. So that's what I'm saying. The significance of the miscoding is that it's then not included in scientific queries about how many complications happen after a Mifeprex abortion.
And the upshot of the Cerucci study basically is that the FAIR system is completely inadequate to give an accurate picture of complications.
Absolutely. Because what we documented is that even you have to understand that what we compared, the Cleland study was only using the information about patients who reported back to Planned Parenthood with a complication. It doesn't even talk about the loss to follow-up rate. And we know that Cleland is a vast underestimation of actual complications, because when you look in detail at what complications Cleland reported, over half of the complications in Cleland were ongoing pregnancy. What happened to all the hemorrhages and all the retained tissue? And, you know, that we know is the most common complication. So Cleland only identified a fraction of the actual complications, and yet FDA had less than half of Cleland's complications.
In light of those, discrepancies and complete breakdown of the public health reporting system for complications, how do we monitor and secure accurate data about complications in the U.S.? Can the states do that, and how?
That's an outstanding question. The states, I believe, depending on the state, and I don't know the laws in each state, but one would think that one would be able to establish a centralized state reporting system for complications for Mifeprex and disseminate that information to ER docs and make it possible for ER docs to actually complete this in a 3 or 4 or 5 checkbox system so that they can complete it in the midst of a busy ER. You're not going to get an ER doc to spend an hour and a half, other than Dr. Francis, God bless her, but you're not going to get an ER doc to spend an hour and a half trying to put together a report, which then can't even be electronically submitted. It's just crazy. So we have to have a real functional and accurate system, and it's got to be disseminated through the ER docs, who are mostly the ones who handle these complications. Then we'll get an accurate picture. And at the state level, it would be better than at the federal level, because at the state level, you actually have state licensure and you have boards that understand the medical system in their state.
So what's available to help educate local physicians, community physicians, ER docs?
Well, there's the Altman paper and the Studnicki paper and the Cerucci paper. The American Association of Pro-Life OB-GYNs, which is the organization I'm CEO of, has a number of very well-written practice bulletins and committee opinions, some of which cover this topic of adverse events from Mifeprex. So I would suggest going to our website, aaplog.org, and under the title of resources, looking down and clicking on those committee opinions and practice bulletins, which explain Mifeprex abortion and its complications. Also, if individually you want to email me, I'd be happy to take questions and try to connect you with as much information as I can provide. And that's just Donna at aaplog.org.
And would you, have a some kind of a perhaps an outline of some of the data you referred to, or a short summary that you could provide as well?
Well, short summary is really hard for me, Clark, but I will do my best to provide something for you with talking points. Maybe I'll do my best to discipline myself down to a page and a half or 2 pages of the highlights from this particular presentation.
Questions about two of the risks of mifepristone that the first is what is the anti-glucocorticosteroid effect, and is that how does that practically affect women? And okay. Secondly, the fatal toxic shock infection, there were 15 years ago, there were 5 cases of fatalities that were reported, but I don't recall any ongoing analysis of that.
There are more cases reported now via the FDA, and we actually have a recent FOIA into the FDA, which they've been stonewalling us, asking for reports of deaths, and they have not been willing to be forthcoming on that. But yes, women have continued to die from Clostridium sordellii. The glucocorticoid effect. So the way mifeprex works is it blocks a nuclear receptor for progesterone. But that's not the only receptor that mifeprex blocks. It also blocks a receptor for cortisol, okay, which is glucocorticoid. Cortisol is involved with our immune system. So blockade of the glucocorticoid receptor makes a woman relatively immunosuppressed for certain types of infection. One of those infections is the fatal Clostridium sordellii. So blockage of the glucocorticoid receptors is significant because of the immunosuppression immunosuppression meaning you can't fight off infection as well. Your innate immune system responds to cortisol, and so if you block that response to cortisol, then the innate immune system just simply can't function as well, and that puts you susceptible to serious infection.
Thank you. What specific studies? With regard to the ACOG practice bulletin, it's justifying mifepristone up to 70 days. I did not see in the ACOG practice bulletin, nor do I know what specific studies the FDA relied upon to justify the expansion to 70 days. What studies do they rely upon? I didn't see any.
That's an outstanding question. And normally the FDA does publish what studies they rely on. I couldn't find it either. And it would be wonderful to get some transparency from FDA, not only about what studies they relied on, but who's on the committee and who's deciding what's an important adverse event and what isn't, and what criteria are being used. FDA is a complete black box when it comes to transparency. They claim agency immunity. They don't have to answer to anyone for anything. They do what they want. And this is a problem. This is one swamp that definitely needs to be drained.
How would you respond to the claim that medical and or surgical abortion is safer than childbirth?
Well, again, at 8 weeks, you do not have the choice of having a term pregnancy or having an 8-week abortion. What you have is the choice of having a term an 8-week pregnancy or ending that 8-week pregnancy. So if you compare apples to apples, which is outcome at 8 weeks, abortion is more risky than carrying the pregnancy at 8 weeks. If you compare abortion at 12 weeks, having an abortion is more risky than carrying a pregnancy at 12 weeks. So again, the way the abortion industry fudges this is they say, oh, well, we'll look at term pregnancy, and then compare that to a 8 or 6 week abortion. It's apples and oranges. It's not the same thing. So when you pass 20 weeks, by the time the baby can survive outside the womb, even if you compare apples and oranges, so 20 weeks and beyond for abortion, it is actually more risky. You're more likely to die from having an abortion than you are from carrying a baby to term. The other thing you have to understand is that the most of the maternal mortality that happens from pregnancy, from live birth, happens after. It's not from the separation itself. So what you've got is very, very, you've got poor numbers all around. Okay. You've got very poor recording of maternal mortality. You have almost no recording of abortion related mortality. So, but at least with live birth, you have an event which takes place in a hospital. And if the death is going to come from the live birth, that's recorded. Live birth mortality, but you're comparing that to unknown. And so because we have unknown abortion-related mortality, the abortion industry can get away with fudging whatever numbers they want, with making up anything they want, because the numbers for abortion-related mortality, especially early, are not collected. They're not collected by anyone. You know, I have to give a shout out to Walter Weber, because Walter, I've used your letter to Gerberding multiple times to illustrate this very point, that you've got an apples and oranges comparison between abortion-related mortality and the maternal mortality quoted for live birth mortality.
And Walter has posted in the chat area a link to his brief that he's filed in the Supreme Court in the Dobbs case that compares and refutes the claim of abortion mortality versus childbirth mortality.
Great.
Which an excellent document I would encourage everyone to read. Donna, we have about 2 minutes left. And I was wondering if you could comment on the One of the discrepancies, I think, in the ACOG practice bulletin is their talk about ectopic pregnancy incidents. And on page 33 of the practice bulletin, they compare ectopic pregnancy rates for insured patients versus Medicaid patients. How in the world is there a difference in ectopic pregnancy rates for insured patients versus Medicaid patients?
Well, as a marker of lower socioeconomic status, it probably has to do with number of partners, because one of the most common reasons for being below the poverty level, or one of the most common correlations, is a single mom trying to raise her kids. So in that case, you have a larger number, you have the possibility of a larger number of partners, which means a larger number of sexually transmitted infections, which means more tubal damage, which means a higher rate of ectopic pregnancy. So it makes sense, though it doesn't have to do with, signing up for Medicaid. It has to do with those factors which put women below the poverty level.
Thank you. Well, we've come to the end of our 60 minutes. Thank you, everyone, for joining today. Thank you, Donna, for your time and insight and expertise. It's been most helpful.
Oh, you're welcome. I was honored to be here.
Thank you, everyone. We'll see you next quarter.
All right. Well, we hope you enjoyed listening in to AUL's most recent quarterly call on advancing the human right to life with Dr. Donna Harrison. If you're interested in joining the AUL Quarterly Calls community, just email us at life@aul.org and ask to get signed up to receive invitations to our future quarterly calls. You can be on the call. You can ask a question live. You can engage over chat. These are hosted over Microsoft Teams, so you can even be on video if you want. Everything we do at Americans United for Life is about advancing the human right to life. We can't do it without your support. So please, if you haven't already, consider going to AUL.org right now, right as you're listening, on whatever device you're listening on. Open up AUL.org, check out the recent work we've done, and make a gift, a one-time gift or a monthly recurring gift. It's very easy. AUL.org/give if you're ready to make that gift right now. Until next time, I am Tom Shakley. Thank you for listening to Life, Liberty, and Law.